Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Martin, you recently posted that Socrates has gone flatline on the Ukraine from an aggregate demand perspective, something that you say has that you have never seen. What does this mean, and why could this be one of the most significant and worrying geopolitical questions of our time?
Well, largely, look, Ukraine put all the propaganda aside. The computer doesn't look at propaganda. It looks at the hard facts. Nobody really expected Ukraine to defeat Russia. All this has been really just simply that they thought Ukraine could be used to weaken Russia, to allow NATO effectively to eventually invade and seize Russia. Trump, did made a sarcastic remark, and he said, "Russia's a paper tiger. Ukraine, you can get all your land back and go take more even." All right. It was all sarcastic. Why? Because that is exactly what NATO is telling everybody over there. They are saying that they have 3.4 million soldiers. Russia only has 1.5. Right. And they make it sound like we can walk into Russia and take it. Zinglin, basically, who was on the January 6th committee against Trump, he's even come out and I think it was NBC News, said we can take Russia in 3 days. I mean, we couldn't even take Iraq in 3 days. All right. But when NATO's out there preaching this, and this 3.4 million figure, that includes Canada and the United States. All right. So, look, I saw the internal memos before when climate change was big and most of the European money was going there. And NATO was beside itself. And I saw the memo saying, gee, how do we remain relevant? There is no purpose to NATO. When communism fell, the Warsaw Pact collapsed, that was the whole purpose of NATO. Our pawn against theirs. All right. Its only purpose in life is to constantly say, oh, Putin wants to take Europe. So give us 5% of your GDP. That's basically it. Putin has absolutely no interest in invading Europe. There is nothing there for it. Okay. Europe has to buy energy from Russia. They have no real gold reserves or anything of that nature. What they're doing is they're using the same narrative of from the communist days of, Khrushchev, we will bury you. But that was a philosophical confrontation. Khrushchev really believed in Marx and Lenin, and that communism was going to defeat evil capitalism that's driven by greed. And so, fine, he said that, back in the 50s, and NATO has been using it ever since. But Putin's not communist. All right. When Yeltsin turned to him, as you know, I was in the middle of all that stuff back then, and they were trying to take over Russia with a regime change, and they got Yeltsin to send $7 billion to basically a refurbishing company in Geneva that nobody ever heard of. And as soon as that wire took place through Bank of New York, Republic National Bank ran to the government and said, oh, they just did a money laundering. So they rushed into that. And So that was really to blackmail Yeltsin. You step down, and they wanted to put in Boris Berezovsky, one of their oligarchs. And I was told back then, if I put in $10 billion into this Hermitage Capital, we'll take over Russia. And I said, my computer said Russia is going to collapse. I'm sorry. It's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And that's when they said, no, you don't understand. We got it all set up. We got Berezovsky. Yeltsin's going to step down, etc. Well, because they were blackmailing Yeltsin with Bank of New York, if you know, the corruption level came to the surface. Mm-hmm. So you had the Russian neocons, the people who did want to take it back to the USSR, they filed a motion for impeachment against Yeltsin. So he was getting it from both sides. That's why he turned to Putin. And the neocons hate Putin because he's the one that shut it all down. The company they wanted me to put money into, he seized. To get Bill Browder running around, oh, I'm Putin's number one enemy. And all this, you know, kind of bullshit, really. I suggest you look at a documentary called the Magnitsky Film Act. I would watch that. But so I think they're back at it again. And it's the same routine. I speak to people high up in France, etc. They call Macron the Petit Napoleon. And nobody cares about the Ukrainian people. You know, you've had Boris Johnson hop on the plane more than once to tell Zelensky he's not allowed to sign a peace deal. You have just had Kalis, oh, there's no peace without us approving. Okay, and then says, oh, Russia's attacking all these civilians. And, well, if you really cared about that, why aren't you advocating peace? You know, this is what happened in Romania, why they overthrew their, you know, the guy that was elected, because most people don't realize they were trying to turn, you know, Romania into the same thing. Mm-hmm. NATO's building the largest military base in Romania. And that's what the people voted against. So then the people, they, you know, their candidate said, oh, he was influenced by Russia. He can't run for president. I mean, it's the same story all over again. And Europe, they think if they conquer Russia, and Ukraine has been used simply to weaken Russia. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you what I've heard, they don't care about not just the Ukrainians, Romanians, all of them. It's like, just hand them a gun, go kill some Russians, and then Western Europe doesn't have to lose anybody. And I said, what is going on here? And response is, well, who really cares? They were all communists before anyhow.
Yeah.
It's really quite disgusting. And look, Zelensky, we had employees there in Kiev and in Donetsk. So one on each side. When, you know, so I know really what happened. I mean, you can look on our site, armstrongeconomics.com. John McCain appeared in Maidan, 2014. Overthrow your government. We're with you. This is about you. This is about your right to peace. You know, all bullshit. You had Victoria Nuland there handing out sandwiches. Yes, overthrow your government. All right. I would look at Oliver Stone's movie, Ukraine on Fire. He investigated. They were taking Ukrainian people there to be shot to claim that the government shot them. And they were doing it themselves. I mean, they will do anything to win. Okay, and look, I've got tapes on my site you can look up. Zelensky is a neo-Nazi. He's like Soros. Before president, he pretended to be Christian. He married a Christian girl, and his children are baptized Christian. And the tapes I got him on stage before being president, making jokes about confiscating assets from Jews and Russians. The Jews I know from Israel, because he was over there saying, oh, now I'm Jewish. Give me some money. All right. And they said, he's no Jew. And I think it was all basically the same thing as Soros, pretending to be Christian, because they were slaughtering Jews all the time. Mm-hmm. And now he's suddenly Jewish. But I was told back then that the Ukrainians, we had on both sides and sources, nobody believes that he actually won an election. They think it was all rigged and he was stuck in. And when he was, I put out a report. I said, look, from what I'm hearing, this is the guy they intend to use to start World War III. And that's all he has done. Mm-hmm. So when the computer's showing a flat line for Ukraine, he doesn't care about the people. He doesn't care about the country. You know, he's out there with Fink. Oh, we're going to raise $1 trillion. How much do I get out of this, you know, to reconstruct, you know, Ukraine? He's out there saying, oh, this will be the biggest investment opportunity in European history. It's how much money do I get out of this? This is it. You know, I speak to Ukrainians, and honestly, they said if he was on fire, they wouldn't urinate on him until he was dead. Mm-hmm. I spoke to military. They were told just to go to the border. They thought they were defending the border. Then at the last minute, they were told to invade Kursk region in Russia. Why? The order came from London, MI6. If we invade Russia, then he'll attack NATO, and we got World War III. Putin knew the game, so he didn't respond. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think this is largely why I got called in. Because I do have, and I was asked, can you use some of your back channels? I said, fine, no problem. You really want me to do this? And then I was actually shown, it was about this thick, I was actually shown the KGB file on the assassination of JFK. Mm-hmm. And I was said, you know, they said to me, they said, you do know what we're asking you to do is what they killed JFK for. I said, yes, I know. But I mean, look, nobody cares if Ukraine, how many people die. The Donetsk are Russians. They've been there for hundreds of years. Zelensky has outlawed their language, outlawed their religion. I mean, this is not something to create peace. This is absurd. Mm-hmm. Estonia is trying the same tactics now, outlawing because there's Russians that live there. And, oh, you can't speak Russian anymore. And you got to change your religion to mine. This is not democracy or anything along those lines. Mm-hmm. So our computer's not very bullish for Ukraine. And we do not see the country is surviving as we know it. It should have been split. Look, if we look at the Czechoslovakia, it's split. Czech Republic, Slovakia. Yugoslavia broke up according to ethnic lines. Croatia, you know, Serbia, Montenegro, Albania. That was the same answer for Ukraine. That was the Minsk agreement. And Donbass should be allowed to vote. the Russians. They want to be, they would prefer to be with Russia than with Kiev. Mm-hmm. Can you blame them? You've outlawed their religion and their language. Oh, yes, let me be with you. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. That's not human nature. So, but the press is so biased. I mean, mainstream media is appalling. It's no different than Pravda from, you know, the USSR days. Like I said, as soon as you see, oh, Russia invaded unprovoked, really? All right. Victoria Nuland installed an interim government in 2014, instructed them to attack the Donbass, unelected. The Washington Post found out that Zelensky knew when Russia was going across the border. Take a look it up. They interviewed him. Why didn't you tell your people Russia was going to invade? His response, it would have cost me $7 billion. That's in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. You know, they get all the information, U.S. satellites, everybody knew the Russian troops were on the border, and U.S. intelligence told them when they were going to cross the border. Oh, but it would have cost me $7 billion if I told the people to get out of the way. They want civilians to be killed. Mm-hmm. This is every war. Why? Because that's part of the propaganda. Oh, look at this. They killed all these innocent people. Get them. It's always the same thing. I mean, look at World War II, World War I. I mean, there are more civilians die than soldiers. You know, they won't talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Martin, what does this new, let's say, peace deal, what are the negotiations like? Is this, are the terms more favorable to what Russia's initial terms were or the Ukraine's?
No, look, the proposal that I was asked to write, they called me in and they asked me to write a peace proposal that Russia would accept. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, fine. And basically, I laid it out that the real enemy is the EU, not Russia. Mm-hmm. All right. Russia has no interest in invading. All this propaganda, oh, they wanted a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Nonsense. Mm-hmm. I had staff there in Kiev. You can look it up. There was a long line of tanks outside of Kiev. It went right up to the city. I told my staff, look, I'll send a private jet to get you the hell out. Mm-hmm. They said, don't worry about it. They're not doing anything. I said, they're not? They said, no, it's just for show. And then he pulled the tanks back. All right. So all this nonsense, oh, he wanted to invade and take all of Ukraine, not true. Okay. And you have to understand, you have to understand your enemy. What makes them motivate the thinking process, etc. Putin is more of a historian. You know, he's criticizing, but everything he said is actually true. Kiev is where the Rus, the Russian tribe, began. So Kiev to him is kind of like London to us. All right. And that's why even when he did cross, his statements were, we are brothers, do not fight us. Now, you replace what I did say in these meetings. I said, you have a choice here. if you really think you can embarrass Putin and force him to abandon Ukraine, besides being delusional, all right, when Khrushchev was forced to do that in 62 over the Cuban Missile Crisis, what happened? That embarrassed Russia. There was a coup, and Brezhnev overthrew him. Then you got the real hardline Cold War. Mm-hmm. When Gorbachev came to power, all right, I did a book, The Plot to Seize Russia, explaining everything that they really were, conniving. And right in the very beginning, I got a hold of all the declassified documents from the Clinton administration. And right in the beginning, black and white, Russia was invited to join NATO. And now, from their neocon perspective, if he did that, that would be like surrendering to their arch enemies. Okay. So they staged a coup against Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. When he was on vacation. That's when Yeltsin had to stand up on the tank, do not shoot your own people, and the military stood down. Because they stood down, the coup failed. And then Yeltsin became president, all right? if you think you can do this again, and force, Putin to actually exit and surrender, you're out of your mind. You're going to get a third coup. And this time, you're going to get one of their neocons. All right. So they knew I was in the middle of all the other ones before. So I guess they needed a fresh perspective. Because we have neocons like every other country does. And, they're trying to get a hold of, they're asking what's their thinking process. And I said, look, I've been trying to get my head around it for a long time. And all I can conclude is, the mantra they say goes back to the communist days. Oh, communism wants to take over the whole world. And they were like saying, oh, we're going to take democracy and spread it to the world. But we don't even have democracy. Vietnam, you were 18, old enough to be drafted. You weren't old enough to have a drink. That was 21. And to vote was 21. Oh, but that's democracy. Here's a gun, go kill somebody. And you have no right to say yes or no. So and their version of democracy is questionable. It's more authoritarian because these people do connive to get power. What started all this bullshit was the Biden administration. You had three neocons that weaseled their way in. Blinken, Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and Garland. That's why Garland went after Trump to try and stop him because he wanted peace. Same thing. Blinken is the one that even had the audacity to threaten China over Taiwan. And if you help Russia, we can do the same to you. As if he's this global dictator. And that created BRICS. Once you took Russia out of the SWIFT system, it was a red flag to everybody else. Mm-hmm. Hey, we don't do what this asshole tells us to do, he'll remove us from SWIFT. Mm-hmm. So they start getting drunk on their own power. So what I said in the meeting, I said, look, all I can say is this. They spent their whole life from the 50s, hiding under desks in school, etc., for air raids or whatever. And it was always Russia, 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 62 crisis and Cuban Missile Crisis. So they grew up hating communism. And communism fell all by itself because it's inefficient. Mm-hmm. And so to them, I mean, I was in D.C. doing some work back on the, you know, the G5 and stuff within the Reagan administration back in 85 when Gorbachev came to power and Reagan wanted to go meet him. And they couldn't say he was a communist anymore. So they said, they switched the narrative. You can never trust a Russian. And Reagan said, stuff it. And he went. If he didn't, the Berlin Wall wouldn't have fallen. You know, but they always want constant confrontation. So I told him in this meeting, I said, look, all I can tell you is this. I think they spent their entire life dreaming about, you know, World War III and Armageddon with defeating communism. And when it fell all by itself, they were just pissed off they didn't get to shoot anybody. Because there's no other explanation for it. China is no longer communist. You know, they didn't change the name of the party because they would have to publicly admit that Mao was wrong. But they got more billionaires than we have. Communism is, means the government owns everything. That's not the case in Russia or in China. Maybe in Venezuela, but, you know, that's about it. You know, but so we have to understand, you know, I see it as the same issue like in the Middle East. We have Hamas. These people have been raised from childhood to hate Jews. You really think they're going to suddenly say, oh, here's all my guns. I love you, my brother. Let's kumbaya. Let's go to synagogue together or something. You know, the neocons are the same way. And China has theirs and Russia has theirs. And these people just, they love war. Mm-hmm. Their hatred of the other side is unbelievable. I said, I met Madeleine Albright. She was another ruthless neocon. She's the one that got NATO to bomb Serbia because they were pro-Russian. You know, she grew up in Czechoslovakia, the same story. If you read Colin Powell's memoirs, he was very upset at her. And her comment was, we got all these weapons, why can't we use them? This is their view. It's not democracy. It's not peace. It's using military force to accomplish my goal. And as I've said, just look at the Biden administration. You had Victoria Nuland, Blinken, and Garland. All three. Three people claiming their families were from the Balkan region. All three claiming that Russians persecuted their families. Mm-hmm. How do three people with the same background weasel their way in and take over the Biden administration? They're the ones that have created all this conflict. Look, I just see it all, you know, everywhere. You got, you know, Caitlis, who's now the, you know, was the former prime minister of Estonia. She's another ruthless neocon. She, you know, actually has come out and said Russia's too big and needs to be broken up. You know, and she also came out and said that, you know, it requires a unanimous vote. dole out, rush it back into the G8. Mm-hmm. And basically said, as long as she's there, that's never going to happen. So in my meetings, what I think I did manage to do was change the narrative. Mm-hmm. That it's not Russia, Russia, Russia. It's the EU, EU, EU. They do not want peace. The EU economy is crumbling before our eyes. We just had the finance ministers of both France and UK admit they might need an IMF bailout. They never, you know, I was called in and they were designing the euro. And they never did it properly. I told them, look, if the euro, you want to compete against the dollar, you have to consolidate the debt. And Helmut Kohl basically was chancellor back then of Germany. And he admitted before he died that if he had allowed the German people to vote on joining the euro, he would have lost 7-3. So he took the euro, you know, Germany into the euro with no public vote. And so he insisted there be no consolidation of the debt. And he thought that's what the German people would be upset about, that they were bailing out Greece and Italy, etc. So I warned them, as a fund manager, I can pick up the phone and say, buy me $10 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. All right. No problem. It's the deepest market in the world. With euro, because they never consolidated the debt, I have to deal with Europe as if the euro didn't exist. Mm-hmm. I still got to make the same decisions. Do I want Germany? Do I want Italy? Do I want France? Nothing changed. There's no federalized national debt. Now, why I say it's crumbling. In U.S. and Canada, the reserves of the bank are the federal debt. In Europe, there is none. So the banks have a cornucopia of the debt of all the member states. Mm-hmm. So after 2010, when Greece got into trouble, what did the traders do? They immediately looked at, who's next? Oh, Spain, whatever. You then attacked any banks that had Greek debt. Short that one. Greece goes down, the bank goes down. All right, so you have France is the second largest economy in the EU. That's just a rumor that they do need a bailout. You're going to start shorting. The traders will all short whatever banks have the most French debt. So that's what I mean. You're undermining the banking system. The pension funds are on average 70% government debt. So what I've stressed to them is that Europe needs war because the structure is unstable, and this continues. People are going to lose their banking accounts, they're going to lose their pensions, and they're going to pick up their pitchforks and storm the parliaments. So, throughout history, governments use an external adversary as a distraction. Mm-hmm. That's why Europe isn't interested in peace. This is why I told them in the meeting, I said, Europe is the problem. Caitlin will stab you in the back every chance she gets. All right. It's got nothing to do with peace. Nobody gives a shit about how many Ukrainians, if any, are still standing. Mm-hmm. Look, I've dealt with governments for so long. There's many times I wish I never got into this field to see what really is behind the curtain. It's just, it is disgusting. But they will, you know, I've said before, I could go in the government and say, look, 25 million people will die tomorrow unless we do this. Mm-hmm. From their perspective, they're going to say, well, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. All right. I could run for office and say, vote for me, I saved your job. And how are you going to, you're going to look at me and like, how do I know I would have lost it? Mm-hmm. Better you lose your job than I say, vote for me, I'll get the guy that did it. That's the way politics works. And what I've seen over nearly 50 years, when I was young, I thought I could make a difference, and you realize you can't. That's the incentive in government. That's why I say there's no mirrors there. We are always the enemy. They will never, every investigation that they start, who did this? It's never them. You know, so they're not going to stand up and say, gee, you know, oh, COVID. Yeah, sorry about that. We made a mistake. I'm not going to say it. That's just politics.
Martin, you brought up
something that they were wrong, then they don't get elected again. Mm-hmm.
You brought up Venezuela. Do you think that because Russia is so focused on the Ukraine at the moment, does this leave Venezuela in a place where it has less allies to support it in a conflict against the U.S.?
Yeah, I think also that Putin realizes he's rejected coming to the aid of Venezuela. Look, the U.S. simply wants it. It's economic. Mm-hmm. Venezuela is the largest oil reserve in the world, more than Saudi Arabia. The American oil companies are probably greasing every possible palm they can. Let us in there. We'll take charge of the whole thing. This is economic. Would they, you know, if you look at the BS here about drugs, all right, that comes from the tariff issue. The Constitution flat outright says any tariff issue is decided by Congress, not the president. There is this emergency statute which Trump has used. And so he's used the drugs to justify national security. He's done that with China as well as Venezuela. So as long as he can say, look, there are drugs flowing from there, it's national security, I can do pretty much whatever I want. Mm-hmm. I believe Ron Paul was putting in a some legislation basically saying that Trump cannot invade a ground attack in Venezuela without congressional approval. So they're trying to cut him off at the pass. Venezuela is kind of a mess in the sense that you have many different groups. I mean, even Hamas is there. So it presents a problem. Does Trump go in and eliminate the Venezuelan army? And then what kind of a government are you going to have afterwards? Mm-hmm. You've got all these fractional groups. Then if you're removing their resistance, which would be the army, then they have free reign. So, I mean, this is not an easy outcome here. Mm-hmm. Venezuela is just a pot filled with a whole bunch of crazy leftists and no real clear solution here. There was an election and Endora, he lost and refused to leave. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, as long as he has the military to support him, then he can stay there. Question is, how long will the military support him? I mean, it gets to be really a real quagmire here.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, do you think that this conflict ends up being far more about energy than about drugs, as Trump says?
Oh, yeah. No, it's more about energy. Mm-hmm. Look, if it was just drugs, then, okay, fine. You would sink all the ships or anything that comes from there. You don't vape. To invade, there has to be a profit. This is why Putin's not interested in invading Europe. What does he get out of it? Nothing. More expense. All right. In the case of Venezuela, if we invade, what do we get? The largest gold, largest oil reserves in the world. It's profitable. So there's got to be a profit to warrant conquest. I mean, this is standard throughout history. If Alexander the Great said, let's go get this country, what are we going to get out of it? Oh, nothing. I just don't like the guy. They go, really? You're on your own. Yeah. The troops, shared in the spoils. So there's got to be a profit to warrant conquest. Mm-hmm. Japan went into Manchuria. Why? For assets, natural resources, which they don't have. This idea that Putin wants to invade and conquer, for what? What does he get out of it? Nothing. It walked into Paris and the French are just simply going to say, are you going to pay our pensions? That's it. Get nothing but civil unrest. There's nothing there to warrant such an invasion. Even Hitler, Hitler didn't bomb Paris because he thought it was pretty. He stole all the art from every place he could. Okay, it was to rule Europe, yes. Okay, but it was still profitable. All right. Putin's not interested in stealing every, painting that they can find around the place. That's not going to pay anything. So Venezuela, that's the big risk. That from their perspective, they've got the biggest oil reserves of anybody in the world. Mm-hmm. And that is a carrot that attracts interest. But on top of that, China is their number one client. So cutting off Venezuela is also a geopolitical tactic against China.
Marty, you mentioned the tariffs that Trump has imposed on countries over, nearly the last year here. Are they constitutional or not? And what does this mean if the Supreme Court finds them to be unconstitutional? What does that mean for the credibility of the U.S. on the world stage?
I don't know about for the U.S., but for the credibility of Trump, probably quite damaging, I would think. Mm-hmm. Personally, if I was on the Supreme Court, I would have to rule against them. I don't think that emergency statute allows him to do what he claims. Like I said, the best thing you can do is say, okay, fine, China with the fentanyl. So it's a national security issue there. But on a wholesale basis, it doesn't, you know, that is a congressional power. So I, you know, he's using that statute, and that's what everything will turn on. Because without that statute, he has no power.
What do you think? You know, there's so many of these conflicts that are, you know, continuing to brew here, Marty. Do you think that, you know, the idea that we're continuing to get into new and more conflicts is a sign to Trump supporters that this, you know, he's really going against this promise of peace that he came into power with?
Look, I think that what our computer has been showing is that we would be going into rising civil unrest and rising international war. Mm-hmm. There's a simple correlation, and I've said many times, war does not come when everybody's fat and happy. War comes when the economy turns down. Mm-hmm. And people get upset, they start blaming the government, it needs a distraction, etc. And what the French did to Germany, World War One, even Keynes, you know, criticized it. It was really retribution because they had to pay, payments to Germany back in 1871. They oppressed the German people so much that there was a revolution in 1918. It was basically a communist revolution, and that created the Weimar Republic. And then money fled the country. And so when that's why the people turned to Hitler, mm-hmm. promising we're going to restore things, etc. All right. So there's always a consequence to this. And what the computer's been showing, and why I say it's world war, is because it's not confined to one place. You're seeing it in the Middle East. You're seeing it in Europe. You're seeing it in Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, India versus Pakistan. It's like wherever there was a grudge, it's all coming to the surface again. Mm-hmm. So we handed a half a dozen jets to Greece and made the front pages. What did they say? Oh, now we can do a sneak attack on Turkey. Another NATO country, mm-hmm. all right? The hatred between Turkey and the Greeks, go back to Alexander the Great. I mean, so it's wherever there was a grudge, they're not forgotten. Mm-hmm. And look, you're seeing it in Canada, West versus East. In the United States, you got, you know, people in California talking about secession. They want to go off to the, you know, Marxist land of never, never, you know. And San Andreas Fault really splits and they can become their own island. Great. Stay there, you know. but you're seeing it absolutely everywhere. South America, you name it. This correlates globally to economic decline. Mm-hmm. And our computer's been showing that we're in a global recessionary period into 2028.
And then in 2028, that just is the start of more conflict, or what happens in 28?
Probably the start of more authoritarianism. Because ultimately, at the end of this, what 2032 is about, we go through these cycles of basically overthrowing governments, because there's really no single form of government that is ever utopia. All right. The last time we overthrew monarchy and we created republics. Hopefully this time we overthrow republics. They tell us we live in a democracy, but we do not. And hopefully I would like to see after 2032, we get back to, maybe a direct democracy this time.
I want to pivot to talking a little bit more about economics here, Marty. The Japanese yields keep climbing. We've heard from some last year that the carry trade was unwound last year. Is this still a hazard, do you think, for the U.S. stock market?
No. What's happening in Japan, if you look at just the statistics, they're, the second largest holder of U.S. debt. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's pick up the rug a little bit. Who owns that debt? It's the corporation, not the government. The corporations are using U.S. debt as the hedge against their own government. Right. The Japanese government can't sell its debt. It even bragged last year that they bought 97% of their own auction. That's a good thing. All these people that talk about, oh, the stock market's going to crash, interest rate. Sorry. Just look, the Fed raised interest rates from 2016 all the way in and started lowering only with COVID in 2020. All right. Stock market rally, they called it the Trump rally. Interest rate, stock market rises with higher interest rates and it declines with lower. Why? Because as there is a good demand for borrowing, the economy is still expanding, interest rates rise. Look at every depression and recession. What happens? Interest rates collapse. Mm-hmm. People aren't interested in borrowing. They don't have. The future is uncertain. That's what I warned the ECB about. It went negative in 2014. They think they could punish people to invest. Look, I'll pay 20% if I think the stock market will double next year. I will not pay 1% if I don't think it's going to go up 1%. Mm-hmm. All right. It's a difference between the interest rate is the expectation of future inflation. That's what it's all about. So as it's rising, that correlates to the stock market rising. These people that, I did a book back in 1986, The Greatest Bull Market. We're going to republish it, but... I did all the research back then, and the thinking process flipped. Before 29, every time interest rates went up, they cheered. It showed there was still a demand for money. Mm-hmm. All right. Interest rates collapsed from 6% to 1%, didn't stop the depression, went down to 32. And there, because of Keynesian and socialism, etc., the thinking process flipped. Oh, the central bank's going to raise interest rates. They want us to spend less. It's what they now want us to do. And that's the problem. So you get all these talking heads, oh, interest rates go up, the stock market's going to go down. Sorry. Show me a chart where that is correct. Mm-hmm. They don't. All right. But this is the myth that they constantly put out all the time. if you don't think the stock market's going to go up 1%, you're not going to borrow at 1% or 0.5%. You're not going to invest. You have to have confidence in the future to do that. That's what hyperinflation's about. Hyperinflation is really when you lose the confidence in government and you don't trust their currency. You don't want that. You want assets. So they call it hyperinflation, but it's really deep, you know, deflation, the purchasing power of the currency.
Marty, silver and the demand that we're seeing for physical delivery here seems to be, you know, getting very heated. Do you see anything out of the ordinary at this time that suggests a dramatic repricing of silver in that market?
Now, there's been a real problem with the whole silver-gold ratio issue. Silver went into backwardation. Now, I think you're looking at the main reason that gold rallied in silver had nothing to do with inflation and all this other nonsense they say in those markets. It's geopolitical. You know, when that's what the BRICS was about. All right. Europe going into war, they're most likely going to do some sort of a false flag next year, maybe even in the first quarter. They need war. You don't want to buy their bonds in times of war. Mm-hmm. So then you don't know what currency is going to survive. The euro is not going to survive. You're looking at Europe most likely breaking up, going back to individual currencies, etc. So at that point in time, what do you really look at? You look at gold, because gold is neutral. Central banks have been buying gold. Why? They don't care if it goes up, and they don't care if it goes down. The issue is they've been dumping, U.S. debt, China has been, and European. Because you go into war. If the U.S. goes into war with China, we're not paying that debt. They're not going to get the interest on it. You don't own the debt of your adversary. I mean, that's, economics 101. So they've been moving to gold, which is neutral. You get the gold bugs, they think it's going up. No, they're not traders. They're not like you, okay? It's basically, you had Blinken threatening them, if you help Russia, we'll do the same to you. Really, that creates BRICS. All right, it's geopolitical. And so I do think you're going to see the prospects of war increasing next year. And you may see the precious metals still push higher into 27 even. Mm-hmm. But it's a war issue, not inflation.
Marty, one of the things that you kind of mentioned there about interest rates, that has to do a lot with the Fed. You know, it's watched so closely by the market, and its importance has grown immensely since its inception. Was it originally a brilliant solution that has now been overused and over-politicized?
Yes. I mean, look, when the Fed was originally created, it was an absolute brilliant design. It was mimicking what J.P. Morgan did during the panic in 1907. And this is why you have, the propaganda, the Fed is owned by private banks. The Jekyll Island books and all this stuff. I mean, the design was that, yes, the Federal Reserve was set up. It was the shareholders were the banks. Why? Because it was to protect the taxpayer. And Fed was to be a bailout operation for banks. So J.P. Morgan in 07 got the banks to bring money together to bail out the bad ones. All right. That was the idea. Now, why do I say the Fed was a brilliant design? Because initially, you take the slogan, lender of last resort. What did that really mean? It meant that you have basically, you have a company. Your local banks are strapped, they're not lending. And so your choice is if you can't borrow, you don't have the cash flow, you got to lay off people. So the idea was you would issue 90-day paper. The Fed would buy it. So that's where the lender of last resort comes from. Hmm. Now you get that money. You don't have to lay off your people. That's the brilliant design. It was an actual direct stimulus to the economy. Mm-hmm. World War I comes. The politician said, oh, we're going to have to issue a lot of debt to cover the war. They told the Fed, buy our debt, not corporate. That set in motion, fine, the Fed's original design of stimulating the domestic economy by buying the corporate debt no longer works. Mm-hmm. Now it's buying the government debt. It stimulates government spending, not the economy. Then FDR comes into play in 1935. He does the Banking Act. He wants to create socialism. He usurps all the power of the Federal Reserve. He appoints the chairman in Washington. Why do we have all these branches? Because the economy has different regional capital flows. All right, Canada, you got more commodity based on the West Coast versus, the East Coast. So, when the Bank of Canada was raising rates to fight real estate speculation in Toronto, they were putting farmers and miners into bankruptcy in Alberta. Mm-hmm. All right, one size does not fit all. So each, you can look in a newspaper from like 1927. You'll see each Federal Reserve branch had a set, was independent. So if there was a shortage of rates, that cash there, they'd raise their rates to 4%. Everybody else is at 3% to attract money there. If they had too much, they would lower it to 2% to deflect money from there. All right. So that was the brilliant design, to actually manage the internal capital flows.
All right. And serve regions instead of the whole country.
So just look at Canada, all right? Why is the idea of separatists taking hold? Why? Because one size does not fit all. You can't have somebody, basically in the East saying, oh, well, I think climate change, so I don't like you people. You should give up all your jobs because of this. This is not democracy. All right. So eventually Canada will split. There's no question about that. This always takes place throughout history. The splits can take place because of economics. They can take place of geopolitics, ethnic issues. There's a whole long list. But countries split all the time. It's not unusual. Mm-hmm. United States. We split. It was a separatist movement from Britain. All right. They called it a revolution, but it was a separatist movement. Mm-hmm. France was a revolution. It was not a separatist movement. That was to overthrow the government, period. So there are subtle differences. You know, in the U.S., it said no taxation without representation. What did that mean? That the U.S. didn't have anybody in parliament to argue their side. So, look, governments have done this routinely for thousands of years. And this is why they fall. You know, if they didn't fall, we would all still be speaking Babylonian, you know? So, the Fed original design was brilliant. Not buying government debt. So this whole thing of like quantitative easing, I warned them that was going to fail. Why? Okay, fine. You're buying in 30-year bonds. In theory, we're reducing the supply in the long term and mortgage rates should decline. Very nice. What's wrong with all these theories? Very simple. It's what I call a fishbowl economy. All right. I warned them. It's not going to stimulate. Why? Because China held a lot of 30-year bonds. They said, oh, you're buying them back? Thank you. They lowered their maturity to 5 years. You know, you come up with these theories as if, and you know, you're buying them only for an American. That's just not the case. They don't understand international finance or anything. Mm-hmm. It's always this, you know, tunnel vision domestically. You know, if you have a building there in Canada, I decide I'm going to buy it. I bring in your price, say $10 million, whatever. I'm increasing your domestic money supply. Got nothing to do with the Federal Reserve or your Bank of Canada. All right. However, if I'm a Canadian and I give you $10 million for the same building, nothing happened. Went from your account to my account. Mm-hmm. All right. They don't understand international that this is not a fishbowl. All right. The fish can jump from one bowl to the next. All right. But look, you know, most of these are academic ideas from the 19th century, and they have not been updated. I was giving a speech in Chicago. I think it was the CompuTrack conference. Milton Friedman came to see me. I got done speaking about capital flows and currencies, et cetera. He came up and to shake my hand. He says, what you're doing is very important. He said, you're doing what I just dreamed about. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? He had written in 1953 about a floating exchange rate system and how the currency would put a check and balance against governments. And that's what I was explaining. I'm getting called into all these different governments around the world. It was foreign exchange. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why I often say I'm the, you know, accidental economist. I was a trader, right? Yeah. I had no interest in becoming an economist or an academic or something like that. And Milton came and he says, you're doing what I just dreamed about. He thought out of the box. Mm-hmm. You could see it. So when the floating exchange rate came in 71, he's the one that got called in to Nixon to explain how it should work. Mm-hmm. He wrote about it in 1953. Mm-hmm. Almost 20 years before.
Incredible how these...
You know, he was not a pure academic. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Martin. Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or to consider for the next, you know, for the near future here?
No, I think that, you know, next year, just be prepared, more volatility, rising civil unrest. Is the governments are going to be more interested in retaining power than reform. And when you put that into their formulas, it means more authoritarianism. And so you got like Stammer over in England putting in all kinds of cameras to track everybody. I mean, this is Stalin, in my view. I know people that grew up in Eastern Europe, and the difference between Stalin's communist world and China was very stark. Stalin told kids in school, if your parent ever said anything against the state, report them. He was paranoid. China was more of the what we call the tall poppy syndrome. They don't care what you say, your wife. You talk to the guy next door, that hit, you know, the poppy's taller than the rest, it gets cut off. All right. Whereas this is what Starmer's doing to Britain. He's so paranoid. Oh, what did you say? You criticize and migrant, which is really my policy. So you're, you know, lock them up. This is, like I said, the English Bill of Rights is gone. And this is what you're seeing. And it's only going to get worse. And Europe, they just put in a law that you want to leave Europe, you have to declare every account you have and where it is and how much money you got. It's all about, it's Marxism, European, you know, utopia, and this is why they need war and all the rest of this stuff. So next year, trust me, it's going to get a lot worse.
Well, with that knowledge, at least we have some idea of what to expect. And of course, you do a lot of that forecasting on your website, armstrongeconomics.com, and on X at Strong Economics. Martin, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. Remember, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's much worse in Europe than it is here. So just be careful about Carney. We would like to install conscription in Canada, all for Europe. So just keep that in mind.
Excellent. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.